Okay, welcome back. The nice thing about meetings at the field and also meetings with mathematicians is that there's always lots of nice breaks. There's sort of a decent amount of time to actually talk to people, so I think it's really good, and I think the medical people need to learn. My name's Amitos. I'm one of the medical oncologists at Princess Margaret Hospital, and my own areas of interest are in new drug development, particularly related to gynecologic malignancies. I'm going to talk to you a little bit about ovarian cancer and give you background of a specific disease where there's a lot that still needs to be done in terms of therapeutic strategies, and perhaps try and sort of spur some interest and discussion in terms of where interactions with mathematical people would in fact be useful. And also, hopefully, this will be a good prelude to Siv's talk, where he's going to talk about some of the things that we've in fact embarked on in ovarian cancer over the past year or so. Again, the reason why ovarian cancer is so important is that ovarian cancer makes up 4% of malignancies in women, and unfortunately still makes up about 6% of cancer deaths in women. So it has a huge impact in terms of its overall incidence and prevalence. The reasons for ovarian cancer being such a problematic disease is that in the majority of women, unfortunately, it's diagnosed quite late. It's called the whispering disease, and the majority of women are diagnosed when the disease has already spread within the abdominal cavity. And because of that, the mortality of ovarian cancer tends to be very high. Approximately, the mortality is about 65% of the incidence rate, which means that unfortunately, the majority of women who are diagnosed, about 75% or so of them, are diagnosed when the disease has spread extensively. And of those women who have present with stage 3 disease, the cure rate is relatively low. And you can see that the 5-year survival figure for patients with stage 3, stage 4 disease is about 10% or less. And as 70 to 80% of women are diagnosed at stage 3 to 4, it shows that there is a lot that needs to be done in terms of the treatment. It tends to be curable if it's actually diagnosed very early. So if the disease is caught when it's confined to the ovary alone, then it tends to be curable. But if it has spread beyond the cavity, then it's I'm sorry for this, but this picture illustrates the magnitude of the problem more than any words. And this is advanced ovarian cancer, and this is disease which has spread within the peritoneal cavity. So unlike a discrete tumor that is confined to a single organ, what happens very commonly in ovarian cancer is that the disease starts seeding throughout the peritoneal cavity. It grows extensively within the peritoneal cavity, and it continues to infiltrate throughout the peritoneal cavity. Interestingly, and this is related to the biology of ovarian cancer, which we still don't fully understand, the disease tends to remain confined within the peritoneal cavity in about 80 to 90% of women. It does not metastasize to other organs as quickly. It can do. It can metastasize in some patients to liver, lung, bone, but that's relatively rare. So even with a massive burden of tumor, the tumor tends to be confined within the peritoneal cavity, and that leads to some opportunities in terms of treatment. So what are the main... Sure.
Which exactly were the cancers?
Oh, okay. So I'm sorry. All of these little blobs that you can see, they're all cancer. So, and these are peritoneal deposits. So that is the bowel, and this is a disease which is on the surface of the bowel. So that basically, if you just orange it, that's the surgeon. There's a midline incision, so that's from top to bottom, and the abdominal wall is peeled back, and this is the inner lining of the abdominal wall, and then you've got the internal organs. There's usually a pad of fat called the omentum inside the abdomen, and ovarian cancer seems to have a tendency to infiltrate throughout the abdomen into the omentum and then studs itself onto the surface of all of the different intra-abdominal organs. So although it starts off in the ovaries, it very quickly can spread throughout the peritoneal cavity. In terms of the treatment, the main therapy for ovarian cancer is divided into surgery and chemotherapy. And conventional wisdom is that we start off with surgery, and the surgeon will painstakingly remove all of those areas of disease that you can see to try and render the disease optimally debulked. So basically what that means is that even though there's fair amount of intra-abdominal spread of disease, if at all possible, the surgeon will try and really resect all of the areas of disease to try and reduce the bulk of the disease as much as possible. Ovarian cancer is virtually the only disease where disseminated disease is still slowly and rigorously resected surgically. There is an increasing trend to try and sort of amalgamate chemotherapy with the schedule for surgery. And the standard therapy that we've been following for a long time has been surgery followed by chemotherapy. Paradoxically, ovarian cancer is fairly sensitive to chemotherapy, so when you give chemotherapy, about 70 to 80% of women will respond well to the drugs, and the disease will shrink down quite nicely. So what has emerged over the last few years is increasingly we're giving chemotherapy before the surgery, reducing the bulk of the disease, and that makes it easier for the surgeon to resect any residual disease. What's still unclear is whether this sequence of therapy is actually the right one, and there's a large randomized clinical trial that's trying to address that. But that's one of the areas that we'll come back on as a potential where we've done some modeling work to try and see if that would be advantageous in terms of sequence therapy and whether we can use modeling in terms of selecting the right sequence of therapy. So what are the ways that we can optimize ovarian cancer treatment? Well, we can optimize ovarian cancer in terms of trying to pick the right type of treatments and the right type of trials. And then Siv will talk later on about mathematical modeling. Just again to give you a bit of a background in terms of ovarian cancer, advanced ovarian cancer, what does it really mean on a sort of day-to-day basis? Let's assume that we have 100 patients with advanced ovarian cancer. If we give patients chemotherapy, 70 of those patients will respond well to the treatment, and we've put down terminology of partial or complete response to therapy, which is there'll be a significant amount of regression of disease with the disease going down in size. In some women, it'll appear as if it disappears altogether radiologically, and those are called complete remissions. The majority, there will still be some residual abnormality, but they will appear to have responded very well. Of those patients who respond to therapy, if you follow them over a three-year period, 20 of them will remain disease-free over a three-year period. So they have a good response to therapy, and the disease truly seems to be under reasonable control. Unfortunately, the majority of them, even though they respond well to treatment, will recur usually between 6 months and 3 years. And if of those patients who recur, half of them will recur very quickly, and the other half will recur a little bit later on. And we define their treatment-free interval as being a predictor of how well they're going to respond to treatment again. As platinum drugs are one of the mainstays of chemotherapy in ovarian cancer, if they recur very quickly, we tend to call them platinum resistant, and if they recur late, we call them platinum sensitive. And that has implications on the likelihood of treatment working again a second time around. Unfortunately, about 30% of women won't respond to treatment at all, and they have intrinsic drug-resistant disease. If you, in fact, look at the impact of chemotherapy on these different categories of patients, the patients who have drug-resistant disease to first-line therapy, if you give them a second line of drugs, unfortunately, they'll still have pretty resistant disease, and only 1 in 10 will generally respond to second-line chemotherapy. So they truly have biologically resistant disease. Similarly, patients whose disease comes back within 6 months of their initial treatment, again, they will have pretty resistant disease, and the likelihood of response is about 1 in 6. Patients who have a slightly longer treatment for interval, so between 6 months and 12 months, or ideally greater than a year, they do have some sensitivity to chemotherapy again, and they tend to respond reasonably well, but their second response tends to last shorter than the first response. So although they will respond, they will not be cured of their treatment, cured of their disease with chemotherapy alone. The only patients who have a reasonable chance of being cured are the patients who are disease-free from the very beginning. Okay. This is just a survival curve, and this is again illustrates what happens when you treat patients with first-line chemotherapy. The standard chemotherapy that we use is a combination of two drugs called paclitaxel and cisplatin. And if you take patients, then over a period of time, as you can see, the plateau on the curve is around 20%. So the majority of patients will progress within the first couple of years, and only a minority will be really truly cured of the disease. So it shows that there's still a lot of work that needs to be done in terms of treatment improvement in ovarian cancer. So what are the different ways of improving treatment in ovarian cancer? Well, we can improve treatment ideally by diagnosing the disease early and prevent. If we can prevent the disease altogether, that would be great. If we can't prevent it, if we could at least diagnose it when it's in stage one, then that would be a huge advance as well. And there are a lot of studies being done to try and see if there's some sort of clinical algorithm that we can follow in terms of trying to pick up ovarian cancer early. So there are some groups of patients who are at higher risk because of family history, and those might be screened a bit more vigorously. There have been a number of attempts to try and do population-based screening, but they haven't been very successful because the false negatives and the false positives are relatively high. So we still have a lot of work to do in terms of trying to diagnose early, and even more in terms of trying to prevent ovarian cancer, because at this stage we don't truly understand what actually triggers ovarian cancer in the first place in the majority of women. So the places where we can improve outcome over a shorter period of time would be to try and improve on the therapy, and that's where we'll talk a little bit about the new drugs that are being used in terms of trying to improve therapy. And the other way of improving treatment is to try and see if we can actually optimize the way we're using our current therapy. So can we actually optimize the use or the sequence of surgery, and can we optimize the use of chemotherapy? And I'll talk about some things that are being done in terms of trying to optimize available treatments. I thought I'd just give you a snapshot of where we're going in terms of looking at new drugs in ovarian cancer. And one of the things that that has been a sort of major advance in all types of cancer over the past few years is a better understanding of the biology of cancer, as Malcolm mentioned. And one of the ways we're targeting several cancers, including ovarian cancer, is to try and, in fact, target angiogenesis. Angiogenesis is a process by which tumors will actually derive the blood supply from the host. The tumors are very clever. They actually get the host to basically supply the tumor with a fresh blood supply. They actually make the host develop blood vessels that actually go into the tumor, and they can derive nutrients from the host from blood supply. So these are brand new blood vessels that a tumor actually causes formation of. And so the idea would be that if you could in fact disrupt this entire process, if you can actually disrupt a tumor's source of nutrients by disrupting angiogenesis, then you would hopefully limit the size of the tumor in terms of its growth potential. And ideally, if you can then combine it with other treatments, you might be able to kill the tumor altogether. There are a number of different factors that in fact allow a tumor to develop this blood supply, and vascular endothelial growth factor, fibroblast growth factor, transforming growth factor, and platelet-derived growth factor are factors that tumors secrete, which will in fact cause formation of new blood vessels. And that this is illustrated here to a certain extent, where you've got tumor cells. They will secrete all of these growth factors. The growth factors will act as chemostimulants, allowing blood vessels to actually supply the tumor. They also have additional impact in terms of making the tumor grow faster, have an impact in terms of proliferation in an invasion, and they also seem to cause the sort of permeability of blood vessels that's often associated with tumors. Now, the reason for targeting this in ovarian cancer specifically is that vascular endothelial growth factor is very significantly overexpressed in ovarian cancer. It makes the blood vessels leaky, and that's a syndrome that we see very commonly in ovarian cancer, in that women present with massive fluid inside the abdominal cavity, and that's called ascites. And the reason for that has been understood recently is that there's a huge abundance of vascular endothelial growth factor that's secreted by the tumors that actually makes the capillary lining of the peritoneal cavity very leaky. That also probably accounts for the distribution of the disease that we talked about earlier in that slide. You saw that the disease was distributed throughout the peritoneal cavity, and that is probably related to the growth factors that the tumor itself produces, and that that controls where the tumor grows and what the impact of the tumor is on the local vasculature. If you, in fact, in animal studies, block vascular endothelial growth factors, then you can, in fact, slow down the growth of these tumors in animal studies. And also, if you follow the levels of vascular endothelial growth factor, and this has been done in animal studies as well as in studies in patients, that actually correlates very well with very poor outcomes. So the more VEGF you have, the worse the outcome in patients. One of the ways of, in fact, trying to block vascular endothelial growth factor is with this drug. It's a monoclonal antibody called bevacizumab, and you may have seen some reference to it in the papers. It's been pretty topical over the past 6 months, and this basically binds and neutralizes vascular endothelial growth factor, and it very quickly reduces plasma levels of vascular endothelial growth factor to undetectable levels. So what are the ways that we can use bevacizumab in an attempt to treat ovarian cancer? Well, there are a number of different ways that have been studied. And the first group of studies in ovarian cancer are sort of outlined on this slide. There were two phase two studies. And phase two study is when you're looking at a study specifically in a patient population that has the same type of disease characteristics. So in this case, ovarian cancer. Two studies where we looked at using one group looked at bevacizumab alone. This was an American group called the Gynae Oncology Group. And we were involved in the second study where we used bevacizumab and we gave low-dose chemotherapy on a schedule that's called metronomic chemotherapy. And Siv will probably touch on this a little bit because one of his students, in fact, did a master's thesis on metronomic scheduling of therapy. The idea is that if you give chemotherapy at low dose levels continuously over a long period of time, I don't see him here, otherwise I'd point you. There he is. Rudy's over there. He's the person who did a master's in the metronomic scheduling. And the idea is that if you give chemotherapy continuously over a long period of time, then it interferes with endothelial growth. Endothelial cells are the cells that, in fact, drive vasculature formation. And so this might be perhaps a more effective way of controlling tumor growth if you can give chemotherapy alone. So these were the two different studies. They were done not in the same center, so I've tried to summarize the two together. So the first study of giving bevacizumab alone just gave the drug at an interval of every 3 weeks at a dose of 15 milligrams per kilogram. The second study gave more or less the same dose intensity. It was giving 10 milligrams every 2 weeks, so the intensity of the drug was the same, and based on the pharmacology, that shouldn't matter. But in addition to that, we gave cyclophosphamide at a low dose, 50 milligrams orally, continuously. And I'm just going to go very quickly through the preliminary results that seem to be interesting. So in the first study, the bevacizumab alone, the complete and partial response rate was about 17.7%. And what was interesting was that the majority of patients had stable disease. Their disease seems to stop growing. So stable disease radiologically is defined as regression up to 20% or growth up to about 20%. So there's some regression or some progression, but overall the bulk of the disease seems to remain more or less stable. And the majority of patients had stable disease, but a significant number had a CR or a PR, and only a small number of patients had increasing disease. Now that's the reason that's interesting just on its own is that if you plot it on a progression-free survival curve and you look at historic controls with all types of previous therapies that have been used, other types of chemotherapy, this is what the historic controls would look like. Basically, patients who have recurrent disease with the same type of disease characteristics have a very poor outcome. When you give bevacizumab, it's interesting that the patients seem to have a much better outcome. Now, this, for clinical trial purists, is not a good way of actually comparing results because you're comparing disparate populations from disparate time periods. But it gives you an idea as to what the results are. And again, this median duration of response and median duration of stable disease was quite high compared to what we had seen previously with other treatments. Looking at the metronomic schedule, which was the second lowest schedule, which gave low-dose chemotherapy as well as the bevacizumab, interestingly, we found that in the preliminary results, partial response rate was significantly higher. In the previous study, the CR-PR rate was 17%. In this one, it was 28%. And that was significantly higher than the other one. And the stable disease rate was about the same, about 62%. And when we look at it further, if you look at the median time to progression in this patient population, it's about 7.5 months. And if you look at the number of patients who whose progression-free survival is 6 months or more, it's 57%. Now, if you're comparing this to the historic controls, this would have been about 15% or 20%. So, based on the very preliminary results on two small studies, this would seem to be an interesting way of treating ovarian cancer. And also, from the two studies, it does seem to suggest that perhaps there maybe some additional benefit to giving metronomic schedule of chemotherapy alongside the bevacizumab alone. So what's the next step? Well, comparing two studies is not a good way of actually making a decision in terms of future treatment of ovarian cancer. So the right thing to do is to basically figure out whether the treatment improvement is because of the cyclophosphamide just being added as an additional drug to the chemotherapy, or whether it's because of the metronomic scheduling of the therapy. So this is what we're proposing. Sorry, ignore this number. It's not going to be that high. The design is going to be a 3-arm randomized prospective clinical trial. Patients will be randomized to one of 3 arms. And the 3 arms are bevacizumab alone. The second arm is metronomic cyclophosphamide plus bevacizumab. And the third arm, we're going to give intravenous cyclophosphamide without the metronomic scheduling, but the same drug, plus bevacizumab. So this trial will hopefully allow us to see whether the treatment improvement that we're seeing is because of the metronomic scheduling or whether it's just because of the addition of cyclophosphamide, because cyclophosphamide does have activity in ovarian cancer. So this is going to be a really interesting study to do, and I think that this does have some implications in terms of what can be done with modeling and then whether the results can be verified. Because if you can actually have a mathematical model and then verify the results in a clinical setting, that actually gives you a validation and proof of principle so that you can actually design future studies based on your model. So that's one of the things that we're involved in. The second thing that I'm going to talk about is intraperitoneal therapy, and this relates to trying to optimize on treatments that you already have. The first part of the talk was on new drugs that we can involve, and the second is, can we optimize therapy? One of the ways that we could perhaps optimized therapy that has been talked about for a long time is to try and give chemotherapy directly into the peritoneal cavity. And the reason for doing that is, as you saw from the first picture, disease tends to be confined within the peritoneal cavity. If most of the disease has been resected surgically so that there's a small amount of disease that's left behind, you might get better penetration of the drugs directly into the tumor by instilling it directly into the peritoneal cavity. And this has been sort of looked at for the past 50 years or so, but more seriously in the last 20 to 30. And there have been five large randomized studies, and each of these randomized studies is a pretty major undertaking, each of them with between 500 to 700 patients, that have shown that when you compare intravenous therapy with intraperitoneal therapy, there seems to be an advantage to giving intraperitoneal therapy. Now, there have been a lot of problems in the way the clinical trials have been conducted, and there's a sort of a long time period to complete one of these studies. It's anywhere between 4 to 8 years to actually complete one of these clinical trials. So what has happened over the past 20 years is that a new study trying to validate intraperitoneal therapy is launched, but by the time the results of the intraperitoneal therapy study come out, the baseline has shifted. So initially they started off by comparing one chemotherapy regimen given intraperitoneally or intravenously, but by the time the results came out to show that the intraperitoneal administration was better, the standard chemotherapy has shifted to a completely different regimen. And because of that, there's been lack of acceptance of intraperitoneal therapy. But a new study is going to come out fairly soon, which in fact shows that the intraperitoneal route of administration does seem to be better. And based on the cumulative body of evidence, the community is gradually beginning to accept that intraperitoneal therapy is something that we need to come to grips with. And probably within a month or two, there'll be a major article in the New England Journal of Medicine accompanied by an alert from the U.S. National Cancer Institute, which suggests that intraperitoneal therapy needs to be looked at carefully. So the studies are summarized over here, and this study, this table basically shows that when you give drugs intraperitoneally, either because of increased dose intensity that you can deliver or the scheduling, overall you can improve on the median survival significantly compared to the same drugs given intravenously. And the study that's going to be published in the near future is going to show that there's an almost 17-month improvement in median survival by giving drugs intraperitoneally. The limitations of intraperitoneal therapy are that, first of all, it's difficult to do. It's associated with a lot of toxicity, and the toxicity can be intraperitoneal infections, hemorrhage, pain, or there can be generalized peritonitis and infections. So there are a lot of challenges in terms of delivering intraperitoneal therapy, but I think it looks as if that there is a sort of new incentive and input to actually try and adopt intraperitoneal therapy more widely. So this may be, again, another way we can look at therapy and to try and see if there is potential for some modeling, perhaps aligning it with pharmacology work that has been done in the past and trying to develop a strategy to try and see if it can be optimized. This is a meta-analysis which actually just puts together all of the intraperitoneal therapy studies that have been done to look at the hazard ratios for death and progression. And if you look at the little red diamonds, if you take all of the studies together, overall there seems to be a significant improvement in intraperitoneal therapy administration. It's not completely clear as to why we're seeing this improvement. I don't think it's as simple as just pure drug delivery, because in the most recent study, half of the women were not able to tolerate the full six cycles of therapy that had been planned. However, if you actually look at all of the results together, even patients who have had two, three cycles of treatment, when you look at an intent to treat analysis, there was still a significant improvement in their outcome as well. So I don't think we fully understand why intraperitoneal therapy works. It seems to work, but if you look at it over here, the average improvement in survival is quite significant. But in terms of just looking at the progression free survival, so that's the time for disease recurrence, in this study particularly, the improvement in median survival was almost 17 months, but the delay in progression that was noted in the same patient population was about 5 or 6 months. So why the survival would be much better than the delay in progression is something that we can't quite explain. So I think that I'm going to end. I think this is probably my last slide. So optimization of therapy. So we continue to work with therapy and trials, but I think that in terms of moving forward and perhaps trying to integrate it into a sort of research framework, I think the main questions that we are interested in and have been working on are looking at sequencing of surgery and chemotherapy, the metronomic chemotherapy delivery method, and to see whether that has an impact. And also, I think we should look at intraperitoneal drug delivery and trying to sort of look at pharmacology and fluid dynamics. So I'm going to end there and hand over to Sif. Thank you.